The viewpoints expressed in the following program are not necessarily those of WRUU, its license holder, or its staff. The following program contains subject matter and realistic language that some listeners may find objectionable. Listener discretion is advised. Well, good afternoon, Savannah. It is just past 12 o'clock on this Friday, and that means you're now listening to Literature with Lee and PT. Now, PT, today we've picked a couple of stories that speak to our times, and not necessarily the larger times that we're dealing with right now, but the holidays
The time of the season.
The time of the season.
Yes.
We just started Passover.
Yes.
Easter is this Sunday.
Yes.
We have lots of holidays coming up, right?
And there are lots and lots and lots of stories that specifically deal with the meaning of these two holidays, but we've picked two stories that have the sense of the holiday there, but don't really deal with the grand meanings of either.
Right, they really deal with the everyday personal and community meanings.
Right.
Now, let me tell our listeners the two stories that we're going to try to get through both of them today, if you and I can. That might be a feat of our own. But one is called Warm Matzah by Albert Halper, and the other one is Two Old Men or Two Pilgrims by Leo Tolstoy.
Right.
Some people might have read the Tolstoy story, but I would put money on the fact that many people have not read the Halper story or maybe don't even know who Halper was.
Well, we need to fix that.
I think so. And I have to admit, PT, I did not know about Halper until I happened upon this story in a book called The Passover Anthology. And it really captivated me. His story, his writing captivated me in part because it made me a little hopeful to think back on Passover's past, because he really captures a lot about, I think, what almost any Passover Seder has been. But he also touches upon family dynamics.
Absolutely. And that's what makes the story a standout.
Right. And I think that was Halper's forte, if you want to know the truth.
It was. He was considered one of the Depression writers.
Right.
When dealing with the family and that sort of thing was much more important. And unfortunately, there are a great many Depression writers, and he might have gotten lost in the mix. He really shouldn't have been, because he has a skill for that one particular thing.
Right. He really is one of the lesser known or lesser covered, I should say, American writers. He was born in 1904. He died in 1984 at the age of 79 from leukemia. But he really was a quintessential American writer. His very first novel was Union Square, published in 1933. But he had several other novels after that, and of course, some plays and many short stories. But as you were saying, he tended to write. So Union Square, obviously, is set in the Depression. He writes about the people of his times,
right?
Or even, you know, later in the 40s, you know, around World War II.
He was really quite active, basically, into the Eisenhower administration, if not quite through it.
Right.
And he started writing in well before the Depression.
Yes, absolutely. And the story we're going to talk about once we get there is a pre-Depression era setting.
It is.
You and I were trying to figure out when he actually wrote Warm Matzah. And it's hard to find.
Well, it's included in a bunch of collections, and you can find all sorts of different copyright dates, but from the story, I think it's pre-Depression.
Yeah, that you get hints throughout the story that it's pre-Depression. Now, he was born in Chicago.
Yes.
This story is set in Chicago. He really was a Chicago man, even though he lived a fair amount of his life in New York.
Right. Well, this is something we ought to talk about a little bit. He was brought up on the west side of Chicago. If you're not familiar with Chicago, the west side is not the baddest side of Chicago. The south side of Chicago is the baddest part of town. And if you go down there, you better just beware of a man called Leroy Brown. But that's not this. This is the West Side. The West Side extends west of the lake, beyond all the industrial part and the high-tone part that's along the lake. At the time that Halper was writing, it was a collection of immigrant neighborhoods, and the one of the larger Jewish neighborhoods was there, and he takes that as a setting. There are some parts of this that seem almost autobiographical. The father in the story is a grocer. Halper's father was a grocer, and they deal with streets and people and attitudes that Halper would have been very, very familiar with growing up. Right.
So this could very well be a story from his own childhood. Maybe that's one of the reasons why it resonated so much with me and made me think of the Passovers of my childhood.
I think it is. And again, that's his skill. Although he did set it in Chicago, it would be very familiar to anyone who's ever prepared for Passover in whatever city in the United States, in New York, in Boston, in Philadelphia, anywhere where the populace was basically immigrant or second generation and grew up with those attitudes.
Right. Now, a lot of his novels, as we were saying, either deal with the depression. They're really about characters in a workplace setting.
Right.
And because of that, because of oftentimes the Depression era themes, or the tenement life that you're referring to.
Right.
He was called a proletarian writer. I don't think he ever really necessarily liked being saddled with that term necessarily. He really wanted to write about everyday working people's lives.
And there was a great deal to write about in that era. And as I said, a number of other writers and artists and musicians addressed the same subject and did it so well. But he had a special talent, I think. And this is after you said you weren't aware of him before you picked out the story. I wasn't aware of him before you said, hey, we're going to do this guy.
Right.
And I was very, very impressed.
I am too, PT. Now, I also pulled some old scholarly articles about Halper. This is one from quite a few number of decades ago, during Halper's time, by Freeman Champney. And Freeman Champney writes about Halper that he takes his people and events on their own terms, and his primary approach to experience is through absorption and understanding. And I really think that sums up at least what I've read so far of Halper.
It does, and I think that's more or less the characteristic of the way the proletarians, if you want to call them that, of his time lived. They had to live that way. They didn't have the control.
Right. Now, Freeman Champney also mentions that Halper's work doesn't necessarily fit into any accepted literary groove, which is one of the reasons maybe why he has been overlooked to a certain degree. And I do love this line as well, that his writing strikes the eye strangely at first and has a strong gamey flavor.
Mm.
I don't know if that's quite so fitting, but Champney talks about how Halper, like I said, he captures the day-to-day existence of the people, of his characters, and these are self-educated characters.
Oh, right? Very much so.
And characters who get up and, you know, are getting through life because they're working day-to-day and they're trying to better themselves in any way they can. And Halper himself, I mean, this is a life that he knew as well.
Oh, very, very intimately.
He was a work-a-day man, too.
He grew up with it, and to the extent we can tell, he lived that way most of his life.
Right.
But there are such small things. For example, in preparation for the feast, his mother basically takes apart the house and puts it back together again. And that was something that people were had been doing for centuries.
Millennia.
Even in the small villages.
Right.
When they lived in the villages, right. Because that's how you establish. If you put up decorations without cleaning everything, people would think that you were putting up decorations in place of doing the right. cleaning.
Well, and this is also an obligation from the Jewish tradition.
Ah.
Yes, right. So, you know, Passover is a one of the many questions we ask during the Seder at Passover. What makes this night different from all other nights? What makes this holiday different from all other regular days or even other holidays? And so, one of the obligations for Jewish families is that when Passover is about ready to come around, you have to clean your house. And get rid of all of the chametz, which is, I believe, translates into leavened bread, right?
Ah.
But people take that in a broader sense. You have to basically clean the house, and if you're lucky enough to have two sets of dishes and two sets of silverware and that type of thing, well, you save one of those sets just for Passover. And Halper mentions it in the story. The young boy who's one of the children who's the narrator talks about how, mother brought out, these sets of salt cellars or this set of plates that we only use once a year.
Mm-hmm.
51 weeks out of the year, they're hidden away because you only bring them out for Passover.
Right.
And the minute I read about the salt cellars, it made me think of, yes, the salt cellars my mother brings out every year. Now, if you weren't lucky enough to be able to have two sets of things so that you can bring the clean ones out for Passover, well, you had to go through rituals in order to make what you use every day into something that was appropriate.
Uh-huh.
My father mentioned to me just off the cuff when I was telling him about this story, he remembers growing up in Denver many, many, many years ago, how his mother used to bury the knives in the yard before Passover to basically, because they didn't have a second set.
Aha.
Yeah. So,
okay.
Yeah. So the story opens in War Matzah. It's the fifth of six children. So a young boy, I don't think we ever know the boy's name. I can't remember. We know the names of all the other children, but I don't know if we know the narrator's name.
I don't know either.
I got to switch over to our story here. Yes.
And Dave.
Okay. Are you
right
sure?
Right on the first page.
Uh-huh. I must have missed that. So the
priest.
Yes, you're right. There we go. Thank you, PT. His name is Dave.
Yay.
Right. So Dave is walking. He's walking down the street one afternoon, and he passes by St. Stephen's, and he sees Father Aiken, and he says hello to Father Aiken. Father Aiken says hello back. And this is interesting. This really struck me as well. This is in the third paragraph, right? This is Dave thinking to himself, narrating the story. I knew the kids inside the church were practicing for Easter services, and I was a little jealous because they were enjoying singing in the ornate gallery above the pulpit, where they could see the glittering architecture and trappings of the holy place. And it's interesting because I know for me, sometimes, I grew up in a synagogue I really loved, but it wasn't a fancy, it was actually an old house that had been converted. And sometimes you think, if you could sit in these beautiful cathedrals or beautiful churches, and sometimes you do get a little envious.
Perhaps, but anybody under the impression that the children enjoy practicing the Easter service
may not be.
has not looked into it deeply.
Right. But then Dave goes, and this is the very next sentence, but I wasn't envious really. I knew that about this time of year, our people had a big holiday too. A whole week during which we celebrated and gorged ourselves on the best food in the world.
Ah.
Now, I don't know about you, PT. I don't know if Jewish cuisine is known as the best food in the world, but there are many dishes at Passover and at other holidays that might fit that category, and other dishes that might not.
There are certainly a mix of dishes, but Nobody ever leaves the Passover dinner
Seder.
Hungry.
No, or sometimes even sober because
that's
you're
true
supposed
too.
To drink multiple full glasses of
right.
wine, like in honor of the seasons. And so, yeah, growing up, this is weird, PT. Maybe it's weird. You know, most kids, when you ask them what their favorite holiday is, they might say Christmas, they might say Hanukkah, they might, right? For me, it was always Passover. And I think it was because we used to have these huge seders. We had a very large family in Denver, and it would usually be at my parents' house. And of course, my mother, just like the mother, Edda in this story, spends, you know, all this time, all day long, all the trying to get ready for the Passover Seder. And then we would sit around as this extended family reading the story of the Exodus of Egypt, you know, while having this beautiful meal. And yes, no, you never left the Passover Seder table hungry.
No, indeed. I have not been to that many, to be perfectly honest, but the meal stays with you for quite a while.
Right. And yes. And because, you know, there's no leavened bread, you know, we have matzo balls that, depending on how they're made, those can stick with you for quite some time.
They can. I am under the impression that the dishes now are derived from what would be a peasant European feast, the things that they would have, not necessarily the bitter herbs, but the chicken certainly, or whatever.
Right. Lots of layers of tradition
mixed absolutely.
In. Right.
And things that they would have had, such as the dried fruits.
Right. Now, one of the things I love about a helper's story is that he captures the everydayness and the non-everydayness of this holiday and this family. As Dave comes home right at the beginning of the story, I think this is just a very, you know, kid and parent relationship, no matter who you are. He says, "I climbed the back stairs whistling a song and coming into the flat said, 'Ma, anybody home?' Which really meant, 'How about a sandwich before supper, Ma?'"
Right.
And here is his mother, you know, engaged in all of the cleaning that she needed to do. And as Helper says, it wasn't ordinary cleaning. It was like tearing the house apart and putting it together again. And getting ready for Passover. There was also no rough talk in the house for the week, right? And Dave and his brothers aren't so happy about that. They understand it, but you know, they basically say, "Look, you know, we couldn't, you know, feast each other and say, 'Give me the ball or I'll pin your ears back,'"
mm-hmm.
like
mm-hmm.
brothers like to do. And of course, the oldest son, who is a traveling salesman.
Milt. Yes.
Ah, he's going to be coming home for Passover too. And there might be some question about, is he coming home? And what does the father say about this? I don't know if you remember, PG.
I don't remember.
Uh-huh. Right? The father, you know, so the father has the...
Oh, he's positive, but I don't remember the exact words.
Yeah, right. Of course he's going to come home, right? You know, this is what you do. No son would skip out on Passover, even though he's traveling all the way in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. You know, it takes a little bit of time to get from Iowa to Chicago.
I am left with the impression that this was as important as it might have been for a Christian coming home for Christmas.
Absolutely, right? And I love the way that Helper captures the interactions of the characters, the relationships of the characters. "How far is Cedar Rapids, Iowa?" my mother asked timidly while Ben, another son, was scribbling away. 100 miles? 1,000 miles, my father answered clearly. "What difference does it make, huh? Tell Milt we're expecting him." but really the whole, you know, well, not the whole point, but a main aspect of the story, of course, centers around the warm matzah that Dave has been selected by his father to help him go pick up the matzah.
For the first time.
Yes, this is Dave's first time. He's very excited about this. Poor his sister Ruth, the only girl of the household. She's just a girl. She's too young. She can't come. The other boys are too young. The other brothers are either not there because Milt hasn't come back yet, or Ben, he's working a job himself. Right. So Dave gets to do this. And the way Helper describes traveling on the trolley through the city to different parts of Chicago that you were talking about, PT,
right,
is just wonderful.
And this is something that he doesn't normally do, so that would have as much excitement as anything that could happen.
Right. And they travel down, Helper mentions, you know, well-known streets in Chicago,
right,
that they're traveling down Halsted Street, right? They approach Taylor Street. And Dave says, look, he says, look, having they soon approached Taylor Street, where the big Jewish settlement began. Having lived in Gentile neighborhoods all my life, I found this section fascinating. Retail stores crowded one another here, displaying all types of merchandise, while at the curb stood push carts manned by aggressive men and women who advertised the good points of their wares, shouting in English and in Yiddish. He really does capture a sense of how different life might have been just a neighborhood over.
Yes, and that's a characteristic of many cities. You can find exactly the same feel, the same culture in parts of New York and parts of Philadelphia,
right,
and parts of any of the cities that had a great number of immigrants.
Right.
And the pushcart vendors and so forth in New York. I was going to say they lasted well into this century, but I'm not sure they're gone yet.
Right. They persist. They continue. And of course, Dave and his father are going to Perlstein's Matzah, a large place that's actually making matzah to sell to retailers to sell.
But, right.
But Dave's father has an inside.
He knows a guy.
Right.
He knows a guy.
Right. And the mother, Edda, had said, look, we don't need so much matzah. You always buy too much matzah. Only 20 pounds. Only 20 pounds this year.
Yeah, that's something I was going to ask about. They wind up buying 35, I think.
It's quite a bit of... Now, they do have six children.
Okay.
Right? But that's quite a bit of matzah.
That's quite a bit.
Right.
Now matzah lasts, but... that's still an awful lot.
Right. And Dave says when he finally gets to Perlstein's, the pleasant smell of the fresh matzah, different from the odor of new bread, filled every inch of the place. He's really enjoying not only the trek with his father, but they said this day is different than his normal days. I also love Helper's description after they buy all of this matzah. Dave and his father are traveling back home. We got aboard a trolley, and as we rode home, my father was silent, his wide face moody. Sitting on the cane seat, I began to feel the heat from the freshly baked matzah slowly working itself through the thick wrappings of paper. In the cold trolley, the warmth was comforting.
Yes, it was. And if you've ever experienced freshly baked goods.
That's right.
Leavened or unleavened.
That's right.
There's a quality to them that you just can't forget.
Right. And I think that sentence right there, or in Helper's whole story, made me feel a little better this year, PT, that even though I can't necessarily have, you know, that large Seder gathering with family and friends, I can experience it again a little bit through Helper's writing.
Yes. Yes, you can. Perhaps the current situation will make us a little more appreciative when we get through it.
Absolutely.
Of these holidays.
Absolutely. On that note, PT, let's take a very brief break for station identification and a few announcements. And when we come back here on Listening to Literature, PT and I might wrap up talking about Helper's warm matzo, or maybe just move on to Tolstoy's Two Old Men.
This is WRUU-LP, Savannah, Georgia, 107.5 FM, WRUU.org. We are Savannah Soundings Community Radio with Global Soul.
Hey
This is a message from the Georgia State Department of Public Health. Social distancing means minimizing contact with people. It also means that if you are near someone in public, try to stay at least 6 feet away. The less contact people have with one another means the less opportunity for the virus to spread. Slowing the spread of the virus means that we can keep our healthcare system from becoming overwhelmed. More information can be found at dph.georgia.gov.
WRUU 107.5 FM is a new and different listener-supported and all-volunteer community radio station for Savannah. Our diverse broadcast and web programming is supported by generous listeners who value our passion and spunk. We are independent of other media and receive no government or large corporate support. People like you are the largest and most important source of our funding. Go to WRUU.org to find out how you can make a one-time or monthly contribution. Thank you.
Well, welcome back to Listening to Literature here on WRUU 107.5 FM. Today, PT and I are talking about some stories related to Passover and Easter. And PT, we were just talking about Albert Halper's Warm Matzah.
We were, and we caucused while the announcements were going on, and we decided not to spoil the story for you.
I think it might not be a story that can be easily found. I think you either need the Passover anthology.
I would recommend people look for it.
I agree.
You can find it if you look for it. But the point to the whole thing is the warm matzah comes to symbolize the holiday for David.
Yes, very much so.
And as the matzah cools, so does the magic of the holiday.
Yes,
basically.
And you also get elements of that in the other characters as well.
Absolutely.
And this really made me think of my own parents who are still working, even though they're probably could have retired many, many years ago. At one point in time, when they're sitting down, about ready to engage in the Seder, Dave, in his narration, talks about his father. His nose was twitching, for the luxurious smells of the food were driving him half mad. All thoughts of his little grocery, with its bills and disappointing businesses, were forgotten tonight. So what you were just saying, PT, if we take that sentence, which is further up in the story, mm-hmm. by the time the Seder is over, right, here was this respite for his father to get away from business for the day or for the evening. But by the time the Seder is over, thoughts of his business come creeping back in. I'm seeing if I can find the quote here.
And again, this is something that happens to people who are not overcapitalized. Real life comes calling eventually.
Right. So the young children are yawning. They're tired. The mother's helping the youngest get ready for bed. The father had been talking with Milt about how business was as a traveling shirt salesman. And then here's Dave's narration again. Talking about his father. Then he broke off and yawned, as if thinking of his grocery, which would have to open at 6 o'clock tomorrow morning for the railroad workers' trade. So you're right. So the matzah, the warm matzah, comes to symbolize how this holiday, how this time together with the family is different from all other days and all other holidays, which is a central question that we ask at a Passover Seder.
I believe it's even in the story.
It is, absolutely, absolutely. Now, PT, we also picked, and this was a selection from you, it's a great selection, a short story by Tolstoy.
It is.
From later in Tolstoy's life, I believe.
Yes, it is. It combines a lot of different themes for Tolstoy. First off, like Halper, Tolstoy was very involved with the proletarian, peasant, really, life.
Yes.
And this is a story that has to do with that. It contains a certain amount of religion, and Tolstoy was religious. it contains a certain amount of, I don't know whether you'd call it anarchism, but at least free thought.
Absolutely. No, especially as Tolstoy got older, he became much more religious and much more spiritual. But for him, he didn't necessarily agree with organized religion. And you can see that in this story as well.
He was at heart, maybe not a political anarchist, but he was certainly a social anarchist. And I think this came from seeing how, at least partially, how peasants were able to work out their own problems right. by themselves if given half the chance. Right.
And very much sort of a nonviolent anarchist.
Yes, very much so.
You know, some of what Tolstoy wrote about and how he lived inspired a lot of our other leaders who've come about who are nonviolent protesters.
He was visited by Gandhi, I believe.
Absolutely.
And a number of people who did make a political mark later in life.
Right. Now, this story is about two old men who are longtime friends who have always promised that they were going to take a pilgrimage. And Tolstoy, literally toward the end of his life, wanted to make a pilgrimage as well and started out on a pilgrimage with his daughter and his physician, but only made it so far before he had health problems and ended up passing away.
He did have health problems. And, of course, as much as he tried to be a proletarian, he could never quite get there. He lived that way. But he had advantages that other people didn't have. And as you get older, that really does count for something.
Right. I mean, he was a world-renowned author.
Oh.
He was a property holder, But I think he was really torn by this.
He found his voice after serfdom was technically abolished. And I think it was 1861. And the things we were talking about with Halper were part of a worldwide movement. People stopped paying attention to princesses and knights and that, and started paying attention to the people who were living the lives that most people lived. And he was enchanted by it to the point of turning it into a virtue, even though it had terrible hardships.
Yeah, very much so. I think that's very well put, P.T. Now, the two old men in his story, again, longtime friends, they have promised themselves they're going to take a pilgrimage to Jerusalem together, and they've been putting it off and putting it off and putting it off for various reasons. And they finally decide, no, now is the time, we should do it, we should go. Now, the two men who are friends are very different. They're different in character. They're different in terms of station of life.
Very different. One of them is intensely organized and very forward-thinking in planning. And
a very sober man. He drinks no vodka.
Very sober man, yes.
Smokes no tobacco. Right.
And drinks no vodka, which is kind of incredible for a Russian peasant.
Yes. That's I remember okay. my time in Moscow, and we won't talk anymore about that.
Okay.
No.
But that's one part of it. The other is a man who kind of hangs loose, if you
right.
will.
Well, the first man, Efim?
Efim.
Efim. Yeah. He also is quite a bit wealthier.
Yes.
And he has a large family, and they all get to live together. The other gentleman, Elijah.
Yeah.
He's a little bit more sort of down to earth. He's okay with partaking of some tobacco and some vodka. He was formerly a traveling carpenter, but now in his older years, he is a beekeeper at home.
He's raising bees, as a matter of fact. His way for paying for this trip is to sell some of his hives.
Yes, right. He has a family as well, but some of his children are elsewhere working,
right?
He doesn't necessarily have them all at home like Efim's children. And Tolstoy does point out that Elijah is named for his holy namesake, the prophet Elijah, whom we always leave a glass of wine for on our Seder table. So there's a little bit of a connection there, I suppose. So they finally decide that they're going to take this pilgrimage, and Ephraim is really worried about whether his son can take over his business and ensure that things stay afloat while they're gone. Whereas Elijah sort of tells his wife and the family that he still has at home, "Hey, look, you know, here are a few things you can do, but I trust you to take care of things the way you see fit."
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And this is this is one of the virtues of being a non-micromanager. You can do that without things going awry.
Exactly. Exactly. And of course, Ephraim has more rubles in his pocket to take with him on their trek. Elijah has some money from selling his beehives, but not as much. But he says, you know, hey, look, I'll scrape it together somehow, right? Raise it somehow.
And he does.
And he does. And he does. So then they begin their pilgrimage, P.T.
They did. This is kind of a neat thing. Immediately, he had left the village. His only cares were to how to please his companion during the way, to avoid uttering a rude word, and to arrive at his destination, return home in peace and love. As he walked along, he whispered to himself a silent prayer or thought of the lives of the saints, so far as he could remember. That is how Elijah is approaching this whole thing. And it should be pointed out, I think, here, Jerusalem is not down the block.
No, this is quite a trek.
It is.
This is quite a trek.
So this is high adventure at any age, and especially for
two older
gentlemen.
That's right. During the first part of their trek, they're coming across villages and inhabitants of those villages who are very sort of excited to see them and are able to shelter them, give them some food, and they try to pay, but the villagers won't take any money.
Right, right.
And things are going really well, at least at the beginning.
Well, yes.
Mm-hmm. But then what happens?
Well, one thing that happens is the pace changes.
Yes.
As you would think would happen, it was after, 5 weeks, their shoes start to give out.
Right.
And of course, now they've gotten through all the things they brought with them, so they're looking for food more often.
Right.
They're not so sure about where they can shelter.
Right. They need to restock.
Right.
And at first, this is going mostly okay, but then they come upon a small plastered cabin with its lower part black and the upper part white. The plaster was peeling off in patches and had evidently not been renewed for many a long day, while in one side of the roof there was a large hole. They come across this house in this village. Now, Ephraim seems to walk a little bit faster and is making far better progress.
Right, right.
Elijah's starting to slow up a little bit, having a harder time keeping up.
And whereas Ephraim looks at people going about their business and worries about whether his sons are doing what they need to do at home
and keeping the business afloat,
Elijah is genuinely interested in what these people are doing.
Right.
And somewhat taken aback by this house where nothing seems to be happening.
Right. So Ephraim kind of moves ahead, goes on ahead, and Elijah says, "Look, I need to find some water. I'll catch up," more or less. And so Elijah goes to this house looking for water, right? Because he's been traveling quite a long way. And he is pretty shocked on what he finds inside this house. There is a family in here, a multiple generation family in here,
who are not doing well at all.
No, they're in the last stages of starvation, as a matter of fact. And, well, my goodness, this is something I just noticed. The woman of the house speaks in a Ukrainian dialect, and these guys have been walking for 5 weeks. Mm-hmm. So they have still a very long way
to go. Yeah. Yeah. This is not all that. We need to look at the pilgrimage overall. This is not all that far into the pilgrimage.
No.
But yes, the children of the house are hiding and starving.
Yeah.
As are the parents. And Elijah starts to ask them, you know, well, what happened? What's going on? And they've fallen on hard times. I think the crop didn't really come in the following year. And at first they were able to kind of get by, but now they've really hit rock bottom.
They have. And as a matter of fact, they don't even have water.
No, right? They don't even have water, right? Tolstoy writes here, of course, in translation, the air in the hut was stifling to the last degree. I think that it just sums up how, you know, Elijah asks, you know, is there no one well enough to wait upon one of the poor women who is pretty much on her deathbed? And the reply is, no, no one. Her man is dying in the yard yonder, and there are only ourselves besides. So they can't even, help themselves, the grandmother, the parents, the children. This is really a horrific prospect to come across. So Elijah, though, he seems to figure out what should be done next.
Well, yeah, when you run across people starving, it's one thing to figure it out, and it's another thing to do it, and he doesn't hesitate.
He doesn't hesitate. So the first thing he does is Elijah unslung his wallet from his shoulders, freed his arms from the strap, and lowered the wallet to the floor. Then he lifted it, placed it on the bench, unfastened it, and taking out some bread and a knife, cut off a hunch and held it out towards the peasant. Instead of taking it, the man made a movement of his head in the direction of the two children. There was a little girl there also behind the stove, as much to say, nay, give it to them. So he begins to share what belongings he has with him with this family.
He does.
But of course, that's only going to go so far.
So he takes the next step and he goes out and buys food, buys water, salt, meal. Oh, and he got a hatchet so they can start to care for themselves again.
And with the little girl's help, who has a little more energy now, is not quite so frightened because she's gotten a little bit of bread. They cook some soup and some porridge, right? And they gave these poor people a meal. And here's what this family says. They said, we used to make a living, poor though it was. But when the crop failed last year, we found we had exhausted our stock by the autumn and had to eat anything and everything we could get. Then we tried to beg of neighbors and kind-hearted folk. At first they gave, but later they began to refuse us. There were many who would have given, but they had nothing to give. In time, too, it began to hurt us to beg, for we were in debt to everyone, in debt for money, meal, and bread. They tried to also get work, but there was almost none to be got. Everywhere there were starving men struggling for work. And so they're starting to get a little bit more energy because Elijah is spending his rubles that he had saved for his trip in order to get them the necessities they need to survive. But it makes me think of the old adage about, you know, how you can give a man a fish and help him eat for a day, right? Or you can teach him to fish and help him eat for a life. Elijah sort of takes the next step here.
Oh, he takes several next steps. Mm-hmm. At every point, at every break point, he thinks to himself, well, now it's time for me to start my journey again.
And try to catch up with my friend.
And then he thinks of something else that needs to be done for these people so they can exist.
Right. And so he takes all of those next steps. Now, what is Tolstoy doing here, P.T.? Why is he telling us this story of Elijah stopping his pilgrimage to the Holy Land in order to help this family in need?
I think he's, well, if you've read the story, he's creating a huge dichotomy
between
Ephraim. Mm-hmm. And Elijah. Ephraim is intent on his objective, and Elijah is looking at the situations he's in, and he's saying, well, okay, I still have this objective, but there are important things to do before I pay attention to that.
Right.
And in this case, running across a starving family is much more immediate and probably important.
Absolutely.
Than showing up in Jerusalem.
Right. Even he's juxtaposing, you know, being a penitent person on a pilgrimage, right?
Right.
There's nothing wrong with that. I don't think Tolstoy would say there's wrong with that.
I think there are people who would tell you that that sort of thing is the essence of Christianity.
Right. And I think that's Tolstoy's point here, that for Tolstoy, the essence of Christianity is helping the poor, helping people in need, helping your neighbor, helping a stranger.
Right.
Right. Because Elijah, you know, he manages to get things that this family needs in order to ensure that they can survive and survive decently even after he is gone, trying to buy back their land to get them out of debt.
Right.
Trying to find a
horse. Now he has taken the final step. He's using the rest of his money to remove the mortgage from their land, get them the beasts they need to farm it correctly,
right,
and so forth and so on.
Right. Now, Tolstoy doesn't forget about Ephraim because, and this is sort of a longer short story that's broken down into different segments. We get to a segment that completely switches, and now we're on the path of pilgrimage with Ephraim.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And Ephraim, I mean, his journey is pretty arduous. Of course, he really does have sufficient rubles to get him there. Although this is a pretty arduous journey, he meets another companion along the way, not a companion like Elijah. He really does miss his friend Elijah, but he makes it to Jerusalem. And he takes all the tours and goes to all of the holy places that one is supposed to visit.
Right. And on the way, has himself some of adventures. The best way to get from Russia to Jerusalem was go through Odessa.
Right.
And take a ship across, I guess it would be the Black Sea, and continue down through Turkey.
Right, right. Now, while he's going to all of the holy places in Jerusalem, it's very crowded.
Right? Uh-huh.
There's lots of pilgrims.
Right.
He thinks, though, he's looking everywhere. Where is Elijah? Has Elijah caught up? Maybe he was able to, you know, to get to Jerusalem as well.
Right.
And he's in all these crowded places, and he thinks he sees Elijah. Ah, there's my friend.
Yes.
Elijah has a bald head, a long beard, but a bald head.
Right.
And he thinks he sees Elijah with his arms stretched out, but he can't get to his friend because there's too many other pilgrims
too
in the way.
Too many other people, right.
Yeah. And so he tries, but somehow Elijah slips out of his sight. He tries again on the second day, and he tries again on another day.
And it should be mentioned, I think, at this point that all of these places he thinks he sees Elijah, these are kind of holy places. One is the Holy Sepulchre, and
right,
so forth and so on.
Absolutely, yes, right, and of course these visions of Elijah with his arms stretched out at these holy
very
places
suggestive,
is
yes,
very suggestive, right? I don't know if we want to, we have about 5 minutes left, maybe a little bit less, PT. I don't know if we want to ruin the end of the story.
Well, there's immense amounts of symbolism in everything we've said, so I think people can take it from there. This
yes.
is another of those stories that I'd recommend that you read, because it gives you some of the genius of Tolstoy without quite the bulk of, let's say,
War and Peace. Right. Although one of my favorites is Anna Karenina, but I did, the first time I read it, I did get very mad at Tolstoy in part of that book. And I won't say any more about that for people who haven't read it.
There are only two characters, and they don't use patronymics, and it For a modern reader, it's a much kinder experience than
yes.
some of the novels.
This is really, like you said, a nice introduction or a way of spending some time with Tolstoy that you can do in one sitting as opposed to many sittings.
But it is a charming story. It's indicative of some of his most cherished beliefs. There are so many ways Tolstoy comes at you. In the descriptions of what these characters go through, you can see yourself plodding through Lower Russia.
Yes.
And seeing all these things. Tolstoy was very good at that.
Absolutely. And, of course, you know, whether it's the holiday or not, they're just beautiful messages in this story, particularly for the times that we are in right now. The description of the peasant family in their household and on this mortgaged farm. Many people in our world, in our communities, you know, near and far, are enduring or will endure states of life just like this, right?
That's absolutely true. And as has been pointed out by several sources, whenever we have an adverse event like a pandemic, the bigger burden tends to fall on the poor.
Right, the people who are already disadvantaged.
Right.
The people who are already dealing with inequities and all, you know, isms or racism and sexism. And,
right.
Right, and of course with and ageism, right? So yeah, so this I love this story right now for many reasons, and that's one of them. It, you know, how do we, you know, right now we are all on a very long journey, a very long trek that we don't know what will come on that journey. We don't know where it ends. How will we attend to the people we meet along the way?
If you look at life overall, isn't that what we're doing?
Yes, right? Any day. So it makes me think a little bit back to Helper and Passover, where we do ask that question, you know, why is this night different from other nights? Why is this time period different from other times? It is, but as you also say, it isn't. These are the things we should be doing on our life's journey with pandemic, without pandemic.
It sharpens our appreciation because the problems are more immediate. The solutions take a lot of the things that would distract us away. And so, yeah.
Right. So obviously, if people want to read The Two Old Men by Tolstoy, that's in the public domain. Pretty easy to find.
Right.
If they want to find Helper's Warm Matzah or any other Helper stories, again, like I said, I found it through the Passover anthology, but Helper himself has an anthology called The Golden Watch.
Right.
That was published in 1953.
Right. And we speculate, or at least I speculate, that since there's a golden watch in this particular story, that maybe he was thinking of the story when he put together the collection.
There's a broader theme. Well, we want to thank you all for listening to Literature here with us today on WRUU 107.5 FM. Stay safe and stay reading.
Bye, y'all.
The viewpoints expressed in the preceding program were not necessarily those of WRUU, its license holder, or its staff. This is WRUU LP, Savannah, Georgia, 107.5 FM, WRUU.org. We are Savannah Soundings, community radio with global soul.